letters, horrible with that. And I always have this fear, I think I've shared this with you before, that someday I will just say something like, after the demons cast Jesus out of the paralytic, they went on to the next town. And you probably won't even think anything of it because you're used to that kind of stuff. But which makes me think I should have just stayed as a brick mason because there's no public speaking involved in that work. But let's practice it together. Epaphroditus. Epaphroditus. Am I saying it correctly? What? Today it's going to be Epaphroditus. I'm not changing it. In fact, I'm just going to call him Frodo because it's close enough. The bigger issue here, of course, is how did something like that ever become a name that parents would ever give their kids? That's all right. So just bear with me. I'm just going to say Epaphroditus all day. Is that going to be okay? How's it supposed to be? I'm not going to be able to learn. I've listened to video. I've listened to this on recordings. I've practiced it.
It's okay.
You're wrong. Just because he's smarter doesn't mean he's right. Okay. All right. Because of what is going on in today's passage, it might be good to have a little review on the reason Paul wrote this letter, the occasion that prompted it, and this will help put today's 12 verses in their proper context. Epaphroditus, one of the servants at the church at Philippi, had been sent to Paul to provide him some support and encouragement while he is in prison. And during that visit, Paul is quite eager to hear all that is going on in what is probably his favorite church. And likewise, the Philippians are eager to hear how Paul is doing, eager for the report when Epaphroditus returns. And they're quite concerned about him. And so Paul prepares a letter to send back with him, this letter, to be read in the church there. Paul uses the opportunity to express several things. He fills them in about his own circumstances and encourages them about how the gospel is spreading because of his imprisonment. He warmly conveys his love for them. He expresses appreciation for their gifts, prayers, and all their faithful support. He encourages them to endure persecution. He has this trial coming up in the Roman court and tells them that whatever the outcome is, life or death, Christ will be exalted, and they are to take that to heart. And he warns them about the false teachers promoting legalism. He gets on them a little bit for the need to pursue humility and unity. And there also appears to be a change in plans regarding Timothy and Epaphroditus, and so he discusses that, and he assures them that he hopes to pay them a visit at some point, pending a favorable outcome of his trial, which he seems to be optimistic about. So you may remember that this letter is very upbeat and personal, unlike Galatians and 1 Corinthians, for instance. He isn't scolding or correcting them. There isn't really that much that needs to be done differently regarding anything that they are teaching or doing. And unlike his letters to the Ephesians and Colossians, this one isn't really an instructional letter, and those tend to be more structured and formal. Rather, Philippians is quite personal, warm, and informal. It's much more like a letter from one friend to another. Though there is, as we have seen, some instruction in it, like the section that we covered last week. So with that in mind, let's now turn to verse 19 of chapter 2. Paul writes, "I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, that I also may be cheered when I receive news about you. I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in your welfare, for everyone looks out for his own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know that Timothy has proved himself, because as a son with his father, he has served with me in the work of the gospel. I hope, therefore, to send him as soon as I see how things go with me. And I am confident in the Lord that I myself will come soon. But I think it is necessary to send back to you Epaphroditus, my brother, fellow worker, and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger, whom you sent to take care of my needs. For he longs for all of you and is distressed because you heard he was ill. Indeed, he was ill and almost died. But God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but also on me, to spare me from sorrow upon sorrow. Therefore, I am all the more eager to send him, so that when you see him again, you may be glad and may have less anxiety. Welcome him in the Lord with great joy, and honor men like him, because he almost died for the work of Christ, risking his life to make up for the help you could not give me." All right, now both Timothy and Epaphroditus, they exhibit the qualities of those who, quote, conduct themselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. If you remember those words from back in chapter 1. And who look not only for their to their own interests, but also to the interests of others. From verse 4 above. Both men are very dear to Paul. They are co-workers in the faith. Both serve as noble examples. And as you can see, our passage here can be divided up neatly into two paragraphs. The first one explains why Paul will send Timothy eventually, but not yet. And the other paragraph explains why Paul intends to send Epaphroditus right away. So let's look at the first paragraph there, 19 through 24. Though we can't say for sure, it does seem that the Philippians had been expecting Timothy and were wondering why the delay. Paul simply explains that he will send Timothy eventually, but not until after the trial. And this is because he still needs him. Timothy, of course, is an exceptional ally to Paul, a faithful servant, especially in times of trouble. Paul commends him, saying that he puts the interests of others first, which was the Philippians' experience with Timothy as well. And so you get the feel here that everyone wants Timothy. And this is because he is such an unselfish and gifted servant. But Paul needs him. As was often the practice of that day, family and friends were responsible to provide for the needs of those incarcerated. And so Timothy was probably that person, as well as being a good encourager and friend. But Paul needs him more for more than just this. As you will recall from chapter 1, opportunities for proclaiming the gospel had really opened up due to his imprisonment. The Roman guards and other workers at the prison, and probably many more, were all intrigued by Paul's incarceration. He was no ordinary prisoner and was therefore the talk of the town. Why is this guy in jail? What has he done? And the answers to such questions really opened up things in a big way. And so Timothy is needed not just to help provide for Paul in prison, but to also help in the mission itself. So Timothy is the man who is on the outside, and Paul really needs him for this. So loyal and selfish is Timothy that Paul even claims, "I have no one else like him." Other helpers and servants have proven to be preoccupied with their own needs, but not Timothy. Paul assures the Philippians that they will get what they want. Timothy will eventually come, but not until after the trial. And when he comes, he will be the one to bring the news of what the court decides. But right now, he just cannot spare his trusted friend and, quote, son in the faith. All right, now for Epaphroditus, the subject of the next paragraph, verses 25 through 30. So again, he has been sent from the church to deliver a financial gift, to get a report from Paul on how he is doing, and to stay there for a while to help with any needs that Paul might have. Now, though the letter doesn't exactly say, one does get the sense here that the Philippians are a bit surprised that he was returning to them so soon. Why isn't he staying there until after the trial? Perhaps that had been the plan. In fact, perhaps he was sent to relieve Timothy, and it would have been Epaphroditus, not Timothy, who would bring back the news of the trial. And on this, we can only speculate, but that particular scenario does make sense of the pieces that we do have here. Whatever the case, it does look like Epaphroditus is coming home ahead of schedule. And the change of plans is because he came down with some sort of serious illness to the point that he almost died. The Philippians heard rumors about this, and they were worried sick about him. And when Epaphroditus heard that they were worried, well, he then became distressed and longed to return to them. So, given how helpful Timothy was to Paul and that Epaphroditus had been through enough with his life-threatening illness and seeing how worried he was about the Philippians, Paul probably thought it best to just go ahead and send him back home. And, Timothy is coming later than you were expecting, and here's why. And Epaphroditus is coming sooner than you were expecting, and here's why. That's basically the essence there of those two paragraphs. Now, Paul may have been worried that the Philippians would have interpreted the early return of Epaphroditus as a failure on his part, that he failed to complete the job that he was sent to do. And so Paul exhorts them to welcome him back warmly with great joy. He highly commends him, saying that he almost died for the work of Christ. Now, it is clear that Paul thinks very highly of him and has great affection for him as well. He praises Epaphroditus as a brother, a fellow worker, a fellow soldier. He refers to them as their messenger, but yet his minister. And so Paul wants to make it clear that he is an honorable man and should be received as such. Fellow soldier, real quickly here from verse 35, does kind of stand out. It tells us that he had, along with Paul and Timothy, suffered the rigors of service to the gospel. Now, if Epaphroditus had died, this is kind of interesting here. Paul tells them that he would have been torn apart emotionally, weighed down with, what's the expression there? Weighed down with sorrow upon sorrow. What an expression. You know, some of our folks here know what that pain is, that pain behind sorrow upon sorrow. Paul may have known it firsthand from a loved one who had died, or maybe he speculated on what it would have felt like. Either way, the expression sorrow upon sorrow is one of those expressions that in and of itself doesn't really make that much sense, but yet as a figure of speech, it does help to convey, powerfully conveys, at least in some degree, the unbearable pain of loss. So as we kind of stand back and think about this, you know, prison was bad enough. Waiting anxiously for a trial, that would be no easy thing. The threat of execution itself was hanging over him every day, and yet his concern was for his fellow co-worker. He worried about him. He prayed for him, and his loss would have been crippling to Paul. And to everyone's great relief and joy, as we know, God showed his mercy, and his cherished co-worker did pull through. Now, it is worth noting that even though there is much emphasis in this letter on joy, we've talked about that some, we do see that here Paul legitimizes sorrow, the pain of losing a loved one, because that's what he was anticipating the possibility of and was really worried and felt that. And he does not try to soften that pain with a pep talk on joy. If there be a place for that in this letter, you think that's where it would be. So Paul could have quoted again something he had said earlier. If Epaphroditus had died, well, you know, to die is gain. Let us rejoice. But Paul doesn't say that. Instead, he anticipates that it would have been sorrow upon sorrow. So, you know, I don't know, but kind of thinking about this, perhaps it's like one thing to use those words about your own death so as to encourage others. But it's another thing to use those words when speaking about the death or possible death of someone else. And this might be something for us to consider the next time we are attempting to comfort someone grieving the loss of a loved one. We have to be careful that we don't, you know, we've talked about this a number of times, that the words that we say are more empathetic than trying to just sugarcoat something in a cheap way. So some observations from this section regarding application. Obviously, these two co-workers of Paul serve as examples for all of us. It is worth noting that Paul talks about travel plans in many of his other letters, usually at the end when wrapping things up. But here in Philippians, we find it in the middle of the letter. And he takes time to elaborate on the admirable qualities of those involved in those plans. And so this is rather unique. It should kind of get our attention. And what's implied here is that both of these men exemplify those very virtues that were the subjects of Paul's previous exhortations earlier in this same chapter. Timothy and Epaphroditus look not only to their own interests, but to the interests of others. They put the interests of others first, indeed. They do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but rather in humility, they consider others better than themselves, and so on. They truly, in all things, both the good and the bad, and both the hard and the easy, conduct themselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. And therefore, serve as living examples, first-hand examples that they would know to the Christians at the Philippian church. All right, and so these two paragraphs here, they're more than just a mere travelogue, as they might first appear. They illustrate how two fellow believers, both well-known to the Philippians, are, quote, working out their salvation, to talk about what we referred to last week, and shining like bright stars in a darkness, of a crooked and depraved generation, from verse 15 above. So throughout the letter, we find a number of calls to imitate. Some are direct, some are subtle. The most obvious call to imitate is to imitate Jesus in the verses above. In the next chapter, Paul even calls on his readers to imitate him But other Christians also merit imitation, like Timothy and Epaphroditus, who embodied the selflessness that God desires in his people. And it should also be pointed out that both men were faithful to their assigned task. They submitted to Paul, not because they were forced to, but because that is part of how they served the gospel of Christ. Interestingly, Paul begins this section here by saying that he made these travel plans hoping in the Lord Jesus. This is probably what James was referring to when he said that we should never get ahead of ourselves and think that we alone are in control of our plans, our future, and our destiny, but to always be mindful of, as the Lord wills, we will do this or that. And this humility is exhibited here in verse 25. Paul makes his plans contingent on the Lord's will. And obviously, there's an application there for all of us. And so, in conclusion, one of the main points we can glean from today's passage is that each of these three men, co-workers together in the early church, Paul, Timothy, and Epaphroditus, are textbook examples of what it means to put the interests of Christ and also the interests of other people above their own. And so let us, with God's help, you know, imitate them in this. That would be a powerful lesson from today's passage. The other application is that if you are imprisoned, make sure that you have someone lined up to be your outside person. That day may come. We are probably closer to it than when we first believed. But next week, we will be looking at verses 11 through, we'll be looking at the first 11 verses of chapter 3. So I encourage you to look ahead at that. And is there any questions today about the material that we covered? In other words, kind of went through that kind of quickly, but all right, good. All right, so do you like short sermons? Let's have the musicians come at this time. We're going to stand. We're going to close with a song of For All the Saints. Again, these are the martyrs and soldiers upon.